Welcome to season 5 of Airtime, presented by AIR in partnership with the great Alamo Drafthouse in Richardson. Airtime is a signature artist interview series featuring artists and creative thinkers in Richardson and the Dallas-Fort Worth area, where artists share about their art and why their creativity makes a difference. It's September the 17th, 2014, and today's guest artist is Tim O'Hare, Tony Award-nominated sound designer, producer, engineer, composer, and multi-instrumentalist. Please give a warm welcome to Tim and our moderator, Chris Tucker.
Thank you, and welcome to Airtime here at the Alamo Drafthouse in Richardson, Texas. Alamo Drafthouse is located on the southwest corner of Beltline Road and Highway 75. My name is Chris Tucker, and I'm your moderator. In my years as a radio announcer for WRR, composer, performer, and conductor, organizations such as Arts Incubator of Richardson engages community with worthwhile events to showcase the arts. Airtime is a program designed to be a collective think tank on the arts, and we accomplish this by bringing in the artists from our community and engaging our audience members. Well, in radio broadcasting, time is an important component, and here at Airtime, we try to keep an eye on the clock. When time is up for a particular section, we'll hear this sound, a desk bell. Please welcome again to the Alamo Drafthouse stage, record producer and sound engineer, Tim O'Hare. It's so great to have you with us.
It's great to be had.
And I want to first start off and say a happy birthday to
you. Thank you.
This
Thank
is your birthday today. A round of applause.
I've never had so many people at my birthday party.
Well, I see you've been quite busy over the years, producing commercials, recording local acts in Boston, day jobs followed by night jobs, producing film soundtracks, sound engineering, collaborating with bands like Sebado and All American Rejects, film score engineer work on films. I'm going to keep going here. Like In the Land of Women, In Good Company, and the film for tonight, Hedwig and the Angry Inch. Do you ever get a chance to breathe?
Yeah, I do.
Before we dive into your sound world, let's take a step back to when Tim O'Hare was just Tim, maybe Timmy, maybe the Timster. A kid seeking a path in life. Was music your calling early on?
I think superstardom was probably my calling, but I decided to give that to somebody else. I grew up listening to AM radio whenever I could, so it was the hits of the day that ruled every move, every motion, and everything I put on my body. So it was kind of like, I come from a time where by the time you're a teenager, you could tell what kind of music somebody was into by the clothes they wore, the way they walked, or their attitude. And it was war. I mean, you stuck to your guns, and you liked what you liked, and everything else pretty much sucked. As you get older, your tastes round out, and you have to admit that some things are actually deserve some merit. But I don't know. I think along the way you start to think. I went to Mass Art, and going to art school, you think, well, maybe I want to do film, or maybe I want to do sculpture or painting, and you start doing all this. But I decided that everything I did had a soundtrack to it, and I spent more time on the soundtrack to each of these things than I did the actual project. So I kind of knew what I wanted to do early on. I played in bands and, you know, made music on my own, but I think that maybe it's the controlling thing, being a Virgo, that I really wanted to be in control of the whole thing, and I felt that I didn't have what it took, what my heroes could do, somebody like, you know, David Bowie or somebody. But if I was behind the glass, these people were the paints on the palette that I could help them make their masterpiece. So it's more like I don't know, it was a very easy thing to get into because I like the technical aspect of it and I like telling people what to do.
Did you study music early on in middle school, high school, or were you?
No, not at all. I was not allowed to have any instruments in the house. My mother was a very nervous woman, and she just, anything that was loud, forget about it. But my grandfather did buy me my first electric guitar, which I proceeded to drag the amp and the guitar out into the backyard, turn it up to 10, and play God knows what. And my mother opened the window crying and screaming. And so, you know, I knew that's what I had to do.
She was probably wishing she had bought you a flute.
Well, when my grandfather was dying, he pulled me in closer, and he said to me, "Timmy, come here." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Come closer." I said, "Yeah." He said, "I'm going to wrap that goddamn guitar around your neck." So, you know, it wasn't something anybody thought could,
right,
you know, become a career, but I think when you sell your soul, that's what you got to do.
Well, as you said, you're Mass-born and grew up in a small town outside of Boston. You found yourself working day jobs to support your nightlife of recording underground bands. How did you learn to be a sound engineer? You mentioned not a lot of schooling early on for music, but did you go to college or was
it more on the job training? Well, I went to Mass College of Art because it was kind of behind the times, and I was into that whole punk rock proletariat kind of thing where you got to make it happen. So whatever they had for equipment for any kind of media, be it video, film, or audio, was about 15 years before it should have been. Everybody else had color cameras. We still had black and white. We had an ARP 2600, and that was about it, and an old four-track reel-to-reel. So I took some student loan money and stole a four-track reel-to-reel recorder from my neighbor, bought a little board and a reverb unit, and I lived in a huge 5,000-square-foot loft in Boston, which those things don't exist anymore. So I had a studio in there, and I kind of taught myself how to do it. And then I lied my way into an internship in a commercial studio, and the rest is a sad history.
So the mass populace has always been enamored with the behinds and goings-on of rock bands. And you've been in this world. Is there any one story, keep it PC now, that you would like to share from your time with those local bands in Boston?
The things you want to share are never PC. You know, one thing I have to say is when I started, when I broke out of the local scene and started working for major acts on major labels, I would sit there and think that these guys who would roll in after work or after school or whatever they were doing with, you know, a crate of beer and broken down drums and half in the bag by the time they got there were far better writers and musicians than the kids who were assigned to the labels. So I started to, you know, it was funny to think that. And that's kind of when you really have to put on your producer hat and say, it's not coming. What do you have to do to make this work? And I think that's something that being a record producer is essential in good music. And unfortunately today, there's no return on the music. So less and less people are using producers and less musicians have the luxury to sit around and experiment and work through something for a whole day and throw it in the toilet because it just didn't work.
So in Boston, you were recording all of these underground indie bands. What collaboration did you find that really told yourself, I am ready to move on and leave the local scene and go national?
I don't think there was any collaboration. It was just that you start getting hungrier and hungrier, and you know you can do it, and you need to prove yourself. And I think it was... I ended up with a producer-manager, didn't work out, got another producer-manager, and I got a gig in Los Angeles. And then a colleague of mine, I remember him saying a year or two before that you can't work in L.A. unless you have a couple of records, major records under your belt, you'll get no respect, blah, blah, blah. I went out there. It was life-changing. It was great. I had been out there to visit and for vacations, but never in the fabric of the whole thing. I worked in a now-defunct legendary studio called Cherokee. It was run by these guys, the Robb Brothers, and it was the history there was insane. I mean, Bowie's Station to Station was made there. couple of Devo records and just things that were just magic in my history. And then driving around LA the day I got there to start work in the rental car and going past all these legendary studios was just, that was the moment that it was like, I can do anything, I can go anywhere, I'm ready, send me anywhere, I can do it.
Well, I'm a professional musician, and it's not just in one genre. I'm passionate about music. I love listening to new works. And what I got to say here is I love preparing for this interview with you because I use this opportunity to check out all those, or at least a good number of the bands that you've recorded and produced over the years. And it was just such enlightening. I loved every bit of it.
Great.
But I got to say, this one band name, I have to ask. Tell us about the Care Bears on Fire.
Care Bears on Fire were a super young band. They were like 14 and 15-year-old girls. And I think the leader may still be going, but they got in, label signed them in New York, and they got in with some producers who basically manufactured what they were doing. So they sampled all the drums and whatnot, and I was kind of brought in to remix and redo a number of songs. And it was really cool because, you know, Joan Jett was a huge hero to the leader of the band, and I had worked with Joan. And to see these kids not following any direction, really just doing what they did, really made me think of what I always thought. It was like I never wanted to copy anybody. You inadvertently do because you wear your influences on your sleeve, but you find yourself, and it was fun because they were so young and they were hungry, and I just let them kind of go and do what they did. I don't know what they're doing now. I'm sure they're busy graduating high school or trying to get into college or something.
Well, they were 14 years old 5 years ago.
Well, they did Letterman. They did everything, man. I mean, they really had it moving.
Well, whether it be Care Bears on Fire or All American Rejects, take us through a typical producing day in the life of Tim O'Hare.
You get to the studio around 11. And sometimes they're there and sometimes they're not. And when I produce a record, I also engineer. It's a control freak thing, but I kind of came up in the world where I like the privacy. I don't like people milling around. And I always think, as a producer, I always put myself in the artist's seat and say, what would I want that person to do? And that's one of the reasons that's how I kind of molded myself. I remember going to a session early on with some friends when I was like 18, and somebody finished a take and said to the engineer, how was that? And the guy was kind of woken up, and he said, yeah, it's all right. And I looked at him. I said, that wasn't all right. I mean, they gaffed all over the place. So, I mean, I looked at that man, and I said, I can help these people. This is not what you need to do. I also heard an interview with a very famous record producer who's a contemporary of mine, who is the president of is the head of A&R for a major label now, and he lives in California and has a long beard and wears a lot of white smocks. And he said, I heard an interview with him, and he said, well, I don't really know what they're doing, but if I need it more yellow, I tell them to make it more yellow. And I said, nobody knows what that means. I need to learn how to engineer so that if somebody says to me, I want a more yellow, I will be able to interpret it and try one or two things, and hopefully on the second pass, I will get it. And I think that's one of my strengths, is because I became an engineer, I know when somebody asks me for something, I can read into it and figure out what they do. I think a record producer it's a traffic cop, it's a psychologist, it's a big brother, it's a daddy, it's an uncle, it's a mommy, it's all those things. And you want to try to remain, as far as I'm concerned as a producer, you want to remain transparent. Everybody has their signature something or other. But I think you need to remain transparent because you need to remain true to the artist, because this is the legacy that this artist is trying to establish. And maybe it isn't these people's lives. But I think every project I've ever gone into, I figured, no, this is it. This is what you're doing. This is your legacy. Little did I know, later on down the line, everybody didn't feel that way, and maybe it was just a hoot or a hobby or something they wanted to try. But I think, to my merit, I always treat it like it's the most important thing. You know, it's it. This is your life.
Oh, absolutely.
And this is your legacy.
That's your craft.
Yeah.
So you found a home in Boston, New York, and now Dallas. For what New York is worth, what brought you to the DFW Metroplex?
Barbecue, 112-degree days. It was a family situation, and you stay in New York for so long, you kind of say, let's try something else. I mean, New York is New York, and it is my favorite place on the face of the earth. And luckily, with a show like Hedwig, I go up there every month, so I get to spend a week there every month. And it changes, but it doesn't change. It's still New York, and I still love it. But it's, you know, as everybody knows, it's just priced out of control. You pay to live in New York, and it's a very young town now, and it's a very transient town. Mm-hmm. And most of the people that I, you know, knew over the past 25 years, if they live there, you don't see them. Most of them don't anymore.
So I figured it wasn't the heat. At least that, it wasn't the heat.
No, I mean, I'm a Yankee, so I do relish the cold. When I went up in February, it was freezing cold, and I loved every minute of it.
Well, let's talk about your connection to the movie tonight and the play that came after it.
And you actually before.
And before. And you actually pronounce it as Hedwig.
Hedwig, yeah, that's how you pronounce it.
Pronounce it in German. Hedwig and the Angry Itch. So this, you were part of the movie. You came in, and they decided, let's do this play, and we want you a part of it. And you received a Tony nomination. Congratulations
Thank
for
you.
That.
Thank you.
Round of applause, please. Thank you. Now, we can talk about both of these projects all day long, and I'm gearing up for that, definitely, if we have the chance. But we only have a little bit of time left.
I can consolidate.
So talk briefly about the preparation for the Broadway play. I mean, bringing rock into the Broadway scene.
Well, I had, in 1999, I got a phone call at my house. I wasn't home, and my girlfriend at the time said, Stephen Trask wants you to call him. And I said, that's great. I have no idea who this person is. And she said, well, you seem like he knew you. I said, I don't know him. Did he leave a number? No. He wants you to call him. I said, well, this is before Facebook and everything. So, of course, I waited. He called back, and he said, I want to work on this record with you. Long story short, it was this band called Nancy Boy. I had been trying to work on their record, but one of the members had left. He got the gig through his work with Hedwig. It was signed to the Disney label. I forget what it was called. Anyway, we met. We did pre-production. It was like we knew each other all our lives, like we were brothers. The record really never came out. Stephen and I have still been very close over the past 15 years. So after we finished that, he said, Hedwig is going to be made into a movie, and I want you to be part of it. And I said, fantastic. I had seen posters in New York for Hedwig. They were Xeroxed, ugly, nasty posters with this ugly drag queen on it. And it said, you know, raunchy rock and roll drag show. And I kept saying, this is right up my alley. I got to see this. Unfortunately, I was working on a record with Jay Maskus from Dinosaur Jr., and he lived in upstate, he lived in Western Mass. So every night that Hedwig showed for 8 months, I was working on this record for those days with Jay. So I never got to see the show. First time I saw the show was when we were at Bearsville in New York. The day before we started recording, I saw a videotape of the show. I knew what to expect. What I didn't know that was, it was very Bowie-oriented, and Stephen hated David Bowie. And I couldn't believe it, but we got into the recording, and we wanted to make it as you know, as much a rock record as a movie soundtrack. We had Bob Mould playing guitar and a bunch of other great musicians. Ted Leszczynski, who's actually the redheaded guitar player in the film, played bass on the album, and Stephen played a lot. And it came out and it did what it did, and it gained the following that it did, and the play, of course, just snowballed, and it's been played all over the world. They even had a Star Search type show in Korea to find the next Hedwig, which was amazing. And John and Stephen went out for that a couple of years ago. But about 8 years ago, Stephen called me and said, we're going to take Hedwig to a bigger thing. We're going to take it to Broadway. And I said, great. And it was kind of like The Boy Who Cried Wolf, because every year it'd be like, well, we're going to do this. You know, we're going to just do two nights or three nights at Radio City, and it'll be a celebration. Last spring, my wife called me and said, did you talk to Stephen? And I said, no. She said, well, you better call him right now. And I knew exactly what she was talking about. So I didn't call him. I texted him, and I said, is it true? And he said, get it together. And I said, what am I going to do? And he said, I don't know, but get your plan together. So what could I do? He wanted me to come in as the sound designer. The production wanted him to use a number of sound designers on Broadway who had proven track records, mm-hmm. Tony Award-winning sound designers, brilliant people. Stephen did not want it to sound like a Broadway show. It's not a Broadway show, and there's some people in the audience here who've seen it, and if seen any other Broadway shows, it pretty much isn't like a regular Broadway show. So the thing I came into it was, I come into a theater, and it's a cavern. It sounds like a gymnasium. What am I going to do? I need live instruments. I need live drums. I'm not going to have electronic drums. I'm going to have a full band on stage. I'm not going to have the drums in a booth somewhere or with a plexiglass shield in front of them. So it a lot of my experience through the years, working back all those years ago with the indie band who came in with their, you know, cardboard boxes for drums and whatnot, how do I make this sound good? So it all really came into play as to, like, I understand I've done live sound off and on for 30 years, and I understand how it works. I had a brilliant collaborator named Kai Harada, who is a very established sound designer who knows how to do 3D CAD design with Vectorworks and design speaker systems for theater. So we got together and we talked about what I told him what I wanted for this room. It's a very old theater, the Belasco. It was built in 1907 by David Belasco, who was the Bishop of Broadway. And I could go through the whole play for you people if you want. Anyway, back then there was no amplification. So you could hear everything brilliantly in every inch of the room from the stage, because that's the way it was designed. It's a beautiful acoustic design. I was going to put a loud rock band in there. How was I going to do that? So, you know, I was thinking of treatments and whatnot, and in Broadway, there's always no money. There's always no money. With $300 tickets, there's still no money. God knows how. Anyway, we made it work. You know, I could go on and do a segment of this that goes on, and I could tell you exactly how it worked, but I basically used my studio experience and brought it into a theater. So I treated it like a live production and also a studio production. So everything is mic'd with studio quality microphones. We went with a console that is known for its mic pre's for the quality of the sound, and it was all about the sound. The show started previews at the end of March. I went up and at the beginning of March for rehearsals, because my thing was, I didn't want to fix it in the mix. I didn't want to have a professional Broadway mixer who I could trust to do the show to understand what was going on. So I got in at the ground floor and worked with the music supervisor and the music director to help arrange the music for the theater, mm-hmm. so that a mixer didn't pull things up and down. A lot of times you'll see shows and you'll notice that when the vocals start, the music slams way down. You can hear it happen. It's like a right angle. And I would not stand for that. It has to be constant. It had to be like a rock concert, because that's what the show is. So we did a lot of things, and it was a learning curve for a lot of the Broadway guys, because they've been doing this for 25, 30 years. And I wanted them to do things a little bit differently. It all seemed to work out. The show won for Best Musical. I got nominated for sound design, and it is a fantastic show, and if you get to see it, it's really a lot of fun.
So at this time, we'll turn questions over to our audience. So if you want to ask Tim anything, please raise your hand and I'll come by.
Hi.
Hi.
So, this.
In the theater business?
In the theater business.
Oh, okay.
And we're actually doing Hedwig. And I was wondering, like, do you have any tips of how you actually...
It's all top secret. You need to hire me to come in and tell you.
What was the process like?
The process is to make it a rock show. Make it a rock concert. Don't treat it like a play. Because it's not a play. It's like a rock concert in the Borscht Belt. I mean, it's... Hedwig is out there with her band to do a show. But Hedwig is Hedwig. And she's all about Hedwig. So she's got to tell you about herself and her story. So that's just asides. Even though it is 50% of the show, the dialogue, that's it. The concert is what's the important thing. And that's what she cares most about. Because she's the internationally ignored song stylist. And she wants to play her songs for you. And I mean, if you know the story, it is about, it's about how she got robbed. And she, you know, she went through this. She found herself, found what worked for her. And it was taken away from her.
Is this thing working? Ah, hi, how you doing? So we were lucky enough to see Hedwig on Broadway a couple months ago, and it was awesome.
Great.
And I noticed the instrumentation and some of the music was very different from both the movie and the original soundtrack. So was that something you had an influence on, or was that something that Stephen and the other people?
No, Stephen, you make more money when you do new orchestrations, new arrangements. So that had something to do with it. But Sugar Daddy's the one that really changed a lot. And Neil Patrick Harris starred in the original first few months of it. And he wanted something just dirtier and sexier than a country rave up. And I loved the country rave up. And I think John Cameron Mitchell did a brilliant job with it. But, you know, when I was first sent the first rough of Sugar Daddy, it just wasn't happening. And I think, all the rehearsal that we did and me being the ears of an audience making suggestions to downbeats and offbeats and syncopation with the bass and things brought it all together. And it ends up working. I've stood outside so many nights outside the theater and heard people say, you know, it was so much better when it was a country version. And I'm kind of like, you know, good for you. You know, and, you know, have their friend argue, I thought this was fantastic. I've never heard it before. It was amazing. Well, it was better as a country version. So, you know, I think a lot of things had to change. You saw the show. There's the whole, the introduction is different because in the film, they're in Bilgewater's, which is like a Red Lobster or a Long John Silver's, and it's hilarious in its own right. But I think making it more poignant, putting it in the theater, and the thing about Hedwig is non-existent, and she's an outlaw, and she basically absconded the theater. And because Bob Wankel told her she could get in there through a few special favors, she's in there just for that one night only performance. So I think that, you know, things evolved, and with each performer, things are different, but the band is super rock solid. It's the best band that ever played Hedwig, even better than Stephen's band who originally played it. I mean, I think everything's really worked out. It's the best arrangements of the songs that I ever heard. I listened to the old arrangements, and I'm like, oh, that wasn't very good. You know, it was great at the time, but I really think that, you know, with 12 years in between, we really got to feel it out. And Justin Craig is the music director. Young kid who's an amazing musician, not a writer, so he could look at it from a musician's point of view and kind of hear what his band was doing instead of being in this writing head or arranging head. So Stephen was there the whole way. I was there, and we kind of, Justin and Stephen and I, who also co-produced the soundtrack album, were really able to make these songs really what they were and what we always heard in our heads. The next version may be different.
What will be your next project after the Broadway musical?
Cabinets in my living room. I don't know. I'm looking for something right now. There's a couple of things. I'm kind of like the rock guy, not the Les Mis guy. So it's I hate to be pigeonholed. I've been pigeonholed so many times with so many things, but it's just safer that way because I generally am not a huge fan of the 60 people on stage singing something I have no idea what they're singing, and the meandering melodies of some 60-line verse. I'm a rock and roll guy, kind of Neanderthal about that, and that's where I come from.
How's the sequel coming?
I haven't seen the sequel. I heard all about it. Have you read about it? No. We'll see. We'll see. I know that Steven's, it's a little twisted. Steven's working on a couple of other projects right now, so I'm sure it will be hilarious, and it will be brilliant.
So the Tonys have decided to drop the sound designer from their...
Yeah, because you know who got the biggest applause at Radio City,
well,
right?
Part of the question there is it too hard for them to understand or discern the difference between good design and bad?
That's what I read. I mean, they don't give there's no video award, and a lot of these shows have extensive video treatment right now. So I think it just took too much time. I don't understand why they lobbied to keep it back in, but I mean, sound design is a huge part of a show because if it's too loud, if you can't understand it, if it's just a mess, people can be running all over the place and you can see all the lights and see all the great costumes. If you can't hear it, what do you get? I mean, a colleague of mine once said that when you're on an airplane, you talk about film, what do you pay for? You pay for the sound.
So, Tim, have you has the whole family seen the show?
Kingsley's seen it about 20 times. He just turned 9. He loves it. He performs most of the songs at home in full drag.
I haven't seen it at all.
It's a little bit racist, as he told me, but that means racy. It's a little racy for a 9-year-old. He's a kid.
What brought you to Richardson, and how long have you been here?
I've been here for a little over 2 years, and just change of pace. Kendall's originally, my wife Kendall Morgan, is originally from Dallas, and her mom was not doing well, and she said, I wish you'd come down, and we said, let's go down, give it a shot. So here we are.
All righty, so we're coming to the end of our show here before we watch this great movie, and we close things out with a game. We call it the Top 10 Shorties. 10 questions, short answers in 1 minute. Are you ready, sir?
Yes.
All right. And we go. Okay. After a long recording and producing career, are you now a night owl or morning person?
Morning person.
Elvis.
Night owl.
Elvis or the Beatles?
Both.
Is there a sound that you hate, and if so, what is that sound?
Journey.
What's your favorite sound?
Oh, sincerity.
Are you a cat or dog person?
Dog.
Other than the arts, what profession would you like to attempt?
Architecture, culinary arts.
If you were given $1 million today, what would be the first item you would buy?
Oh, jeez. Buy my wife out of her job.
What's your favorite car?
E-type Jag coupe, probably 1971, 72.
That'd be the second thing you'd buy then. A figurehead or artist that you draw inspiration from in your daily life?
David Bowie, James Bond, Frank Sinatra.
And the last question, what are you wishing for on your birthday today?
Oh, I can't say that on that microphone.
A round of applause for Tim O'Hare. This is Airtime, created by Arts Incubator of Richardson, and I'm your moderator, Chris Tucker, here at Alamo Drafthouse in Richardson, Texas. Airtime is underwritten by Alamo Drafthouse, Dr. Barry Knezik, Christensen Davis, LLC, and Eric L. Wise, and funded in part by the City of Richardson through the City of Richardson Arts Commission. We invite you to check out artsincubatorrichardson.org for future events and news.